Welcome back to Cyber Mornings Daily, everybody. We have got a really interesting collection of stories for you all today.
Yeah, these are some fascinating stories. I mean, they really touch on a lot of the things that we see every day in the news. Whoa. But, you know, it's our job to take a deeper dive and go past those headlines and understand what's really going on at a technical level.
You know, I think one of the things that really struck me when I was looking at these stories is that it's really kind of a tale of three very different worlds, right? We've got the world of genetics.
Right.
We've got the world of the cloud.
Yeah.
And then we've got the world of, you know, our smartphones and the apps that we use every day.
Right. It's all connected.
It's all connected, but it's also very distinct in terms of the types of vulnerabilities, the types of threats, and the types of impact.
Absolutely.
So should we just dive into the first story here?
Let's do it.
All right. So this first one. This is really fascinating because it kind of speaks to this this tension that we're seeing more and more in the world of technology between, you know, the ideals of open data sharing and the very real concerns about privacy and the potential for misuse of that data. So we've got this platform. It's been around for like 14 years.
Wow.
And it's dedicated to the open sharing of genetic information.
Yeah.
So people could contribute their genetic data, their phenotypic data.
Yeah.
It's been a really valuable resource for researchers.
Hardly.
You know, kind of offering an alternative to those big commercial DNA testing companies.
Yeah.
But now they've made the tough call to shut down completely.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to be deleting all the user data by April of next year.
So next April 2025.
2025.
That's a big decision. What drove them to that?
So it seems like the main reason is this, you know, this heightened awareness of the risks associated with having this kind of very personal genetic data out there.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
The co-founder was specifically talking about concerns about misuse by, you know, authoritarian governments.
That's a huge concern these days, you know, with the advances in things like, you know, DNA analysis and you know, the ability for governments to really track individuals and to use that data in ways that, you know, maybe weren't even conceivable when this project first started.
Right. And it's a testament to, I think, the founders of this project that they recognize that, you know, they built this with, I think, the best of intentions, really wanting to democratize access to genetic information and to help advance research. And it sounds like they actually did. I mean, they made some pretty significant contributions, even helping to debunk some flawed scientific studies along the way.
Wow. That's impressive. So it sounds like they were making a real impact.
Yeah, it was a pretty significant repository of data. And, you know, it's interesting because a big chunk of their data came from people who had also used 23andMe, which we've talked about before, you know, one of those big direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think that says something about the desire for people to share their data more broadly? Like, they're going to these commercial companies, but then they also want to contribute to, you know, these open science initiatives.
Right. I think it speaks to this idea that people are, you know, they're interested in learning about their own genetics, but they also recognize the value of contributing to something larger.
Yeah. It's like a, it's almost like a sense of, you know, collective ownership of this information.
Right. But it also kind of highlights the challenges of maintaining a platform like this over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the bankruptcy filing by 23andT apparently significantly reduced the inflow of new data.
Mm.
So it's not like this was a, you know, constantly growing and thriving hub anymore.
Right. So they're losing their data source.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because they had reportedly declined offers in the past to sell control of their data to corporations.
Really?
Yeah, they were clearly committed to this open model. But now they feel like the risks are just too great.
So even though they resisted the temptation to, you know, cash in on this data, they're still making the decision to shut it down. I mean, that really speaks to the seriousness of these concerns.
Right. They're not requiring any action from users. But if you happen to have contributed your data to this project and you want to keep a copy for yourself, you'll need to download it before April 30th, 2025. After that, it's gone.
Wow. It's like a digital time bomb.
It is. It really is. It's a really tough situation. It highlights, I think, this need to constantly reevaluate the balance between open science and privacy.
Totally. And, you know, I think it also speaks to the responsibility of platforms like this to really think about the long-term implications of the data they collect and to be transparent with their users about those risks.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to our next story. And this one takes us into the world of the cloud. And specifically, it involves Oracle, which is a major player in the cloud computing space.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting about this story is that it's not just about a data breach. It's also about how those breaches are communicated and the kind of sometimes the murky distinctions that are made between different parts of a cloud provider's infrastructure.
Oh, this sounds juicy.
It is. So it seems like Oracle has been privately confirming a data breach to some of its customers, but they're being very careful about how they're describing it.
What are they saying?
They're saying it only affected what they're calling a legacy environment.
What does that even mean?
Right. So they're specifically referring to something called Oracle Cloud Classic.
Okay.
Which they claim hasn't been actively used since 2017. So they're trying to kind of downplay the significance by saying, oh, this is just old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where things get a little bit more complicated. The alleged threat actor involved in this breach is claiming to have data that's much more recent, including data from late 2024 and into 2025, which they've shared on a hacking forum as proof.
So they're calling Oracle's bluff, essentially.
Exactly. And it raises questions about whether this legacy environment was really as isolated and inactive as Oracle is suggesting.
Right. I mean, if they're still holding data from last year and this year in this supposedly legacy system, that raises concerns about how they're managing their data and their infrastructure overall.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting that cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike and the FBI are reportedly investigating this incident. So it's definitely being taken seriously.
Makes sense.
So the initial reports before Oracle started privately confirming this breach were pretty detailed. They suggested that this attacker might have gained access to these older Gen 1 servers, as they're calling them, as early as January of this year. And they might have exploited a known Java vulnerability from back in 2020.
A 2020 vulnerability. Wow. So this is like an unpatched system that's been sitting there for years.
Potentially. And this vulnerability could have allowed them to do something called remote code execution, which essentially means they can run their own code on that server.
Oh, that's not good.
No, it's not. And once they had that level of access, they could have potentially installed things like a web shell, which is basically a backdoor that gives them persistent access.
Right.
And according to these reports, what they managed to extract from this supposedly legacy system is pretty valuable. User email addresses, hashed passwords, and usernames from the Oracle Identity Manager database.
Oh, wow. I mean, even if the system is older, that's still sensitive information?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, email addresses and usernames can be used for phishing attacks or to try to gain access to other accounts. And while the passwords were reportedly hashed, meaning they've been scrambled, those hashes can sometimes be cracked.
Especially if they used an older or weaker hashing algorithm, right?
Exactly. So it's not like this data is useless just because it's from a so-called legacy system. And then, to make matters worse, there's this threat actor who's been trying to sell this stolen data online. They're using the alias Rose 87168.
Okay.
And they were offering like 6 million data records for sale on a hacking forum back in March.
Wow. 6 million.
Yeah. And they even provided samples as proof. And what's really interesting is that they claim this data came from Oracle Cloud's federated single sign-on servers.
So that's how they're linking it back to Oracle.
Right. But what's really confusing here is that Oracle initially publicly denied any breach of Oracle Cloud.
Okay, so wait. Are they saying that this Oracle Cloud Classic, this legacy environment, isn't actually part of Oracle Cloud?
It seems like they're trying to make that distinction.
That's pretty misleading.
It is. And, you know, as a cybersecurity expert pointed out, Oracle Classic is still part of Oracle's overall cloud offering. So for a customer, it might not be as clear-cut as Oracle's making it seem.
Yeah, I mean, if your data is in Oracle's cloud, it's in Oracle's cloud. It doesn't really matter what they're calling it internally.
Exactly. And this whole situation kind of highlights the importance of clear communication from cloud providers when these kinds of incidents happen, because it can be really confusing for customers to understand what's really at risk. And just to add another layer of complexity to this whole thing, Oracle also reportedly notified customers about a separate breach at Oracle Health, which is their healthcare division.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this one apparently involves some legacy Cerner data migration servers. Cerner's a company that Oracle acquired.
Okay.
And it seems like attackers gained access to these servers using compromised customer credentials. And now there's a threat actor who's going by the name Andrew, who's trying to extort the affected hospitals, demanding cryptocurrency to prevent the stolen data from being leaked.
Oh man. So we've got two separate breaches potentially affecting sensitive data, and Oracle is trying to downplay one of them by calling it legacy.
Right. It's a mess. And it really makes you wonder about the overall security posture of Oracle's cloud infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, are they really taking security as seriously as they should be?
It's a legitimate question. And, it's something that any organization that's considering using cloud services should really think about. You need to do your due diligence, understand the security practices of your provider, and make sure that you're comfortable with the level of risk.
Absolutely. I mean, the cloud can be a great tool, but you have to go into it with your eyes wide open.
For sure. Okay, ready for our final story.
Hit me with it.
All right, so this one might hit a little closer to home for a lot of people because it involves something that many of us probably use on a daily basis, Verizon's call filter app.
Oh, yeah. I use that all the time to block spam calls.
Me too. It's a pretty handy tool. But it turns out there was a vulnerability that could have allowed Verizon customers to access the incoming call logs of other Verizon wireless numbers.
Wait, seriously? So, like, I could have seen who was calling you?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
And you could have seen who was calling anyone else on Verizon.
That's crazy.
It is. It's a really significant privacy risk. And it was all because of a flaw in the way that this app communicates with Verizon servers. So, a security researcher named Evan Connolly discovered this vulnerability back in February. And Verizon did fix it fairly quickly, sometime in March. But the exact window of exposure isn't clear.
Okay.
So, for those who might not be familiar, the Call Filter app is basically a tool that helps you identify and block unwanted calls. It uses a variety of techniques, like looking up numbers in a database of known spammers or using algorithms to analyze call patterns. And it's often pre-installed on Verizon phones.
Right.
Now, Connolly focused on the iOS version of the app for his research, but he suspects that the Android version was probably also affected because the vulnerability was actually in the API, which is the application programming interface. That's basically the set of rules and specifications that allow the app to communicate with Verizon's servers.
Okay, I'm following so far. So, what was the actual vulnerability?
So, when the app needs to retrieve your call history, it sends a request to a specific endpoint on Verizon's API. And this request needs two main things. First, it needs a JWT, which is a JSON web token. This is basically a digital token that verifies your identity.
Yep.
And second, it needs something called an exec-MDN header. This header specifies the phone number for which the app is requesting the call logs.
All right.
Now, the vulnerability was that Verizon's system wasn't properly validating whether the phone number embedded in your JWT, so your phone number, actually matched the phone number that was specified in that exec-MDN header.
Oh, I see. So I could have used my own JWT, but then changed the header to request your call logs instead of mine.
Exactly. And the system might have just handed them over.
Wow, that's a pretty big oversight.
It is, and it's a good example of why input validation is so important in API design.
Right. You need to make sure that you're only giving people access to the data that they're actually authorized to see.
Exactly. And what's even more concerning is that the researcher didn't notice any rate limiting on this API endpoint. So theoretically, someone could have automated this process to scrape call history data for a huge number of Verizon subscribers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it could have been bad. And, it's not like call logs are completely harmless. I mean, they can reveal a lot about a person.
For sure. Like who they're talking to, when they're talking to them, how long they're talking.
Right. It can be pretty revealing. And, to Verizon's credit, they did fix this issue quickly once it was reported to them, but it definitely raises concerns about the security practices around this kind of sensitive subscriber data.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder what other vulnerabilities might be lurking out there.
Right. I mean, this wasn't some super sophisticated attack. It was a relatively simple flaw that could have had pretty big consequences. And, it's just a reminder that even those apps that we use every day, the ones that we think are safe and trustworthy, can still have these vulnerabilities. So it's important to be aware of the risks and to take steps to protect yourself.
Yeah.
Keep your software updated, be careful about the permissions you grant to apps, and be skeptical of anything that seems too good to be true.
Great advice.
Well, there you have it. Three very different stories, but all with the same underlying message. Digital security and privacy are more important than ever, and it's on all of us to be aware of the risks and to take steps to protect ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think the key takeaway here is that this stuff is constantly evolving. We
Right.
need to stay informed, we need to be proactive, and we need to keep asking questions.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for our deep dive today. Thanks for listening to Cyber Mornings Daily.
See you next time.
We'll catch you all next time with more insights from the ever-evolving world of cybersecurity.